Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and joined today, absolutely delighted to be joined back on Reboot Republic by Professor Linda Connolly, who's the director of the Maynooth University Social Science Institute and author, and Ciara Riley, lecturer in digital education in the Merino Institute. Ciara and Linda, it's great to have you back.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Difficult times. We are, I suppose, the last time we were talking to you, it was, I think, if my memory serves me right, about 100 years ago, I think. We say that each day in lockdown when you have a child under 3 is equivalent to 1 year. And each day you have a child under the age of 7 is equivalent to 2 years. So I'm on about 3 years every day. And it does feel like time is going very slowly. But there's, you know, a lot of parents who are in a very difficult situation right now. We know there's a lot of stress out there, a lot of vulnerability. A lot of people, particularly, you know, parents of special needs, people in, you know, overcrowded housing situations, people who don't have access to digital supports. There's a lot, of, you know, in many ways, so many inequalities. And we, you know, are trying to, with this podcast, I suppose, give people advice because, you know, you both are expert educators and support, but also, you know, highlight what should be done and what could be done better. Because I think that is really important that we have these conversations. There is a problem, I think, at the moment in Ireland. There's a fear of critique or somehow a closing down that if you question or if you challenge or you question, you're somehow you know, going against the whole national attempt to try and deal with COVID, which of course is complete nonsense. And, you know, why we end up in a lot of these situations is because there's not actually discussion and dialogue. And so we maybe start with one of the, I suppose, you know, what your sense is of where we are at right now. And I know, Ciara, you've some updated news as well in terms of what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks. But yeah, just for parents and of course educators as well, teachers, you know, we are lecturers, we're teachers, and teachers as well in schools, you know, are really in a difficult situation as well. And you know, everybody is trying their best. So it is about trying to figure out how we do the best, both for health wise and for our children and for us all. So maybe, Ciara, if I go to you first, if you want to give your sense of kind of where we are at now in terms of education within this lockdown.
So it's been a very difficult couple of days and weeks since the new year and since the most recent lockdown has been announced. I think the third level sector, it has been probably the least impacted because we had been expecting to maintain the status quo, really. We had obviously hoped to have some face-to-face engagement, but we were fully prepared to just remain doing what we were doing.
Yeah,
I think what has happened to the schools and to the educators and to the parents impacted has been really, really challenging, really difficult, and absolutely could have been avoided. And the announcement this afternoon that there will be the ability to open up schools, special schools, and some places for those children who are in mainstream schools, who are receiving special ed support. The fact that that was announced today proves that had there been consultation a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, with the unions and with the parties involved to make sure that everybody was involved in the decision to open up and to proceed with school opening, it just proves that it could have been done. And the seesawing of last week, seesaw, by the way, excuse, no pun intended, I'll come to that in a minute, and distance learning. The seesawing of last week, the will they, won't they, will they, won't they, I think served absolutely nobody. And what I'm fascinated by in this space is that everybody seems to think that that the Department of Education and that the minister is dealing with this, everybody, I mean, in the commentariat, seems to think that we are dealing with the school system exceptionally well. And it's only the stakeholders, it appears, that nobody, that seemed to be shouting from the rooftops about the difficulties. And for me, where we're at in the last couple of days is, I tweeted out a comment and I got a number of people responding to it about how I feel that the minister has really lost the dressing room, and that in the last couple of lockdowns and the last school closure periods, people were broadly working with the system and were there and stepping above and beyond and were happy to just, even though it was very difficult, they were happy to go with it and make it happen. And they maybe didn't agree with all elements of it, but they felt, look, we're all in this together. I just feel that's definitely been lost now. That's definitely been lost. And that's where I'm at as regards the last couple of days and weeks. I just feel that people in education feel like they're so frustrated. They don't feel like the department are working with them anymore, that there's a sense that the department are working against instead of for schools. And the real victims here are the parents and the children involved, who are not being served by this back and forth politicking. So it's been a really difficult few days, I have to say. And I'm not directly involved, but I found it emotionally really draining seeing colleagues and friends, and, you know, whether they're educators or parents, going back and forth and back and forth. You know, it's very difficult.
Yeah, no, it is. And, you know, and as a parent and an educator, you know, I see both sides, you know, and I have family members who are teachers as well. And, you know, like I have a junior infant and a first class, you know, child, and just seeing, like, and they're, you know, capable, you know, for children who are fine. And, you know, they're, you know, traumatized is probably a very strong word to use. But, you know, it is this kind of, you know, collective, you know, stress of trying to, you know, you're managing work, you're trying to get them to engage on a Zoom quiz. And I was talking, or not a Zoom quiz, there's my head gone. A Zoom, that's what it's like, a bloody Zoom quiz. But the, you know, the teachers are doing their best with it. But, you know, a junior infant, trying to get them to sit in front of a screen and...
But you know, that's exactly it there. You're after identifying it. Success and survival at this time wears many hats, and it looks very different to lots of different people. And I say at my level, and what the space in which I lecture and I support schools on, the digital space works really well for so many people. And for some parents, they are really concerned about how many hours of Zoom classes can I have access to? How often do I need to post to the child Seesaw page? Meanwhile, then you have another group who that is the least of their concerns, and they're not capable of engaging with the system at all. So basically what we're seeing is some people are included, and there's an inclusivity to this school closure period and to all of them, but particularly this one. And then there's others absolutely excluded, and they were already marginalized, so they're further entrenched in this divide.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is the real question, you know, how, and again, I know, like, teachers and the school system, you know, want to, and they care, and they do so much work with, you know, people in disadvantaged situations, kids with special, you know, additional needs, that, you know, it again points to, like, that kind of narrative of trying to blame them, you know, blame the teachers, the school system has blocked this, rather than actually going, no, that's not the case, that, you know, that this, the education system, the school system, the schools, teachers, principals, you know, absolutely care so much and do practically, and that there, you know, it showed the absence of the dialogue, the absence of leadership, I think, within the Department of Education and government to actually, you know, see how do we respond to this situation, rather than tokenistically saying, you know, and even I say this every time, I'm struck by the Leaving Cert, you know, when I said that, you know, it was like the Leaving Cert is going to go ahead no matter what, you know, and you're going, what? Yeah, no matter what, if people die, the Leaving Cert goes ahead. And you know, what are you saying to people? What's the purpose of education? You know, what's the purpose of what we're doing over the coming months? You know, that it is about survival and people looking after each other, and teachers and students. Linda Connolly, Professor Linda Connolly, what's your sense of where we're at?
Shock and awe comes to mind in some way. If we kind of step back a minute, so I think, first of all, we should have been prepared for this, you know. Yeah. And, you know, I, as you remember when I was on the last time, I had written a piece the end of August in the Irish Times, which talked about the importance of having a plan B, but we also need, in a way, a plan C and a plan D. And I hate this word, Rory. It's used in all kinds of sectors. But this idea of being able to pivot in a pandemic is really important, that this idea that it's the highway or no way, it just doesn't work. We went from a situation before Christmas with the lowest rates of COVID to the highest in the space of, was it a week or 10 days? So that's, I mean, we should have been planning since the 1st of September, in my opinion, for the likelihood that in a pandemic, there will be periods when schools either have to shut fully, as we're in a situation now. I just listened to the NEFID briefing tonight. 44% of all cases in this pandemic were in the last 2 weeks. I mean, it's actually even upsetting saying that. Mm-hmm. So we're in the peak of this pandemic. I mean, that is an enormous number of cases in 2 weeks since this began in Ireland. And, you know, preparing and planning for schools and education has to be able to deal with the best case scenario when we're all in schools and bubbles and whatever else, and everything is working fine and there's the odd case here and there, and we have been in that situation. It's been wonderful. It was absolutely massive work done, certainly with my children, who are a bit older than yours, in the kind of 11 to 16 age bracket, three of them, and they really did fantastic work in the first term, and it's really standing to them now in the online context. But likewise, we also need to be able to pivot onto the worst case scenario situation, and we are there, and it happened really, really quickly. So that's the first thing, I suppose, be prepared, as we used to say in the Girl Guides or the Brownies or whatever, but really, it's honestly, you know, the idea that there's one way and it's the highway or no way is bonkers, quite frankly. So that's the first thing I would say. And it's very sad we're in this situation, but we are. And that figure, just of the number of cases, and, you know, a lot of kids as well, their grandparents have COVID or they've lost somebody recently. Mm-hmm. You know, Christmas Day seems to have really impacted a lot of families with COVID. Mm-hmm. So my sense is, I suppose, to answer your question, is we weren't prepared, first of all. And secondly, the situation is pretty bad. Having said that, I always try to see, I suppose, how we can move forward. And again, I haven't been that impressed. So you, I completely agree, Carol, with what you just said there. So not only have we the highway or no way, but what we've seen emerge really is, in that kind of blanket treatment, schools will open, you haven't seen the nuance we need around the vulnerable, around the most needy, in a sense, in terms of reaching out. So you know, education, my sense is the opposite, because my children are older than yours, but online is going really well this time, you know, and I've talked to a lot of others, parents, neighbors, teachers in my own family as well, Rory, including SNAs, and you know, their sense as well is it's going much better now. This would be for the older age group, not the little juniors and senior infants, although I have talked to some parents as well who said that's actually going better this time as well. So we're better able, I think, our resilience as parents, educators, teachers' resilience, and indeed the children's resilience, I think, has built up. Now, I haven't done the study to prove that, but that's just my sense, Rory, to again answer your question. So definitely there's more online presence, particularly in the secondary. They're on at 9 in the morning and they're doing more. And I hear coming out of the bedrooms, the digital bedrooms, a lot of laughter in this lockdown. Yeah. The kids are talking to the friends in between and they've got used to it, you know. Now, I'm not saying it's ideal, but I think it's better than the first lockdown where we were just kind of, I don't know, we were all in a standstill and it was very stressful. This lockdown is stressful, but it's different, I suppose. We have experienced this before. So I think that's important. Yeah. So just to say that that is the positive. But the complete negative then, I suppose, is the way in which the sector has been dealt with and the communication. It's very top down. It's very blanket. It's not nuanced. It's this way or that way. And that's why I think it is important, you know, putting the cart before the horse, you know, the issue of dealing with, you know, particularly the whole area of special needs, but also the children of key health workers as well. It's like it's been dealt with after the event rather than before. But having said that, I think it's positive now that we do see what in social science, Rory, we call a more intersectional approach, perhaps, to looking at this, you know, where we can provide education all the time in the same way to everyone, but we can start in a staggered way, if it's safe, with prioritising those who can't deal with, you know, lockdown education, who have more needs in a way. And it is about prioritising those groups, the healthcare workers, before the others who can work more effectively online, you know, even if it is not ideal.
But Linda, I would say there you have identified the real nub of the issue, and it's that when it comes to the management of education in this state, there is a complete lack of creativity and out-of-the-box thinking.
Yeah.
And when we are presented with alternatives, they are nonsensical, a la the three-day week model for Leaving Cert students, which there was no evidence supporting that rationale. Mm-hmm. And people get incredibly frustrated when kites are flown and ideas are thrown out there and there's no engagement with science, evidence, and the people on the ground who we want to deliver these supports, you know. On the same day that that kite was flown, it was announced that they felt that it wasn't safe for the doll to sit as frequently and that they would only be sitting one day a week. And they had to roll back on that. I had suggested it would be appropriate, perhaps, that the cabinet would sit in a classroom 3 days a week because they're obviously the safest places to be. So you have them talking out of both sides of their mouth. And that, I think, is the major issue this time. People just aren't prepared to be kind of spoken at anymore. Like, there's a real way Norma Foley, I think, speaks at educators this time. And there's this sense of, my favorite word for it is being voluntold. You're great, you're fantastic, educators are wonderful. And you're nearly made feel like, well, it's completely patronizing, I feel. And it's this sense of, you can take this hit and you're going to take this hit. And regardless of how safe or rather not safe it is for you to be in the workplace, you're going to have to take this hit because ultimately, and this is a point I've made in this podcast many times, we cannot function as a society unless our schools are open. And the decision to maintain school opening was primarily an economic decision. And there are some people who, yes, they have in a very valid and authentic way spoken about the impact that this has had on children. But I think we need to just be very clear here. Schools need to reopen. Your mainstream schools need to reopen so that people can get back to work because we have not factored in any alternative. I also think as well, there's a sense that if our schools are functioning and the traditional state exams that we are morbidly obsessed with, and that's a conversation as well to have, that everything's working. Society is ticking over once the schools, when the schools close, it's like, okay, this is serious now. And it just goes to show how important our schools are to the fabric of society, the relational, the societal network that we provide in our schools. May we never take it for granted again after this time.
Yeah.
You know, and eaten bread is soon forgotten, but I tell you, we need to hammer that point home, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Ciara, you know, highlight again, you know, very eloquently and clearly, you know, the key issues around this, that, you know, that talking down, and it comes back to me, like, you know, teachers are experts, you know, parents are experts, children are experts. Why the hell were they not brought in to talk and work out this plan together?
Yeah.
You've identified that they would claim, the powers that be, that discussions had happened, but they hadn't happened on the meaningful level that they needed to in order to account and accommodate for all of the needs and supports of everybody involved. I think what was interesting this time was when that announcement was being made about the Leaving Cert, and special schools, that I thought it was fantastic to see educators, students and parents united to as a on block and to really take this on as an issue. Mm. I genuinely don't think the unions could have won this on their own. This was overturned. All credit to the students and the parents who spoke up and who advanced their agency and you know, exerted their influence. But I do think we need to ask questions as well about our unions. Do I think we've been absolutely best served by our unions throughout all of this? I'm not so sure. I think, in fairness, we have regained ground in the last couple of days in particular. But I think, for example, the talk about, oh, let's close the schools early in December to reward teachers for what they've done. That shouldn't have been the narrative that was exposed at all. It should have been close the schools because it'll be safe and then people can see their family and there will be a longer incubation period, etc. So when the unions are making kind of statements like that, not all of them, but some of them, it does not serve teachers well. And then they're not bringing people with them and they're not ensuring that the key relationships are looked out for. So look, I mean, it proves with the decision being made today, it proves that had adequate and appropriate consultation taken place, then the upset, and it is actually, I would say it is traumatic for the parents and children, the parents of children with special and additional needs. It has been traumatic to rip their association and relationship with school from under their feet when they had told children and prepared them for the return to school. All of that could have been avoided.
But the mixed messages as well, with, you know, again, this very top-down view, simplistic message, schools are safe. All the evidence suggests schools are safe. And to me, it's about how you frame it. So, so the school situation might be safer than being in a lecture theatre with 400 sociology students, for instance, you know, because it is this so-called, as it keeps being termed, controlled environment. But in and of its presence and participation in society, education is not safe alone. So it doesn't exist as a kind of an island apart. So it's more honest to say that the schools are only as safe as society is in a given point in a pandemic. And that's a more honest way than saying schools are safe. Absolutely. You must all go at the same time without any kind of sort of in between analysis of, you know, if there are high rates in a particular community or areas of the city, for instance, you know, there's absolutely no nuance to this. It is blanket, top down. And in a way, it's almost like, I call it a kind of, it sounds a bit like a civil service view of education rather than, and I think this is what you're getting at as well, Keir, that than the education we know as people who participate in the system and our children participate, that it is a relational context. It's a very important part of our lives, our family lives, and so forth. So that seems to, if you think about the whole model of partnership, you know, that so much work was done on the whole partnership model. In this, in terms of our experience of education, it doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. I think the unions, to be honest, again, there's a gap between, and I can't speak for teachers, but there appears to be a gap between what teachers want or what some teachers want and what the unions have been agreeing to. And again, we might have had some of that in you know, all of us in our sector as well, where, you know, the universities were going to be opened. And of course, you know, this was going on for weeks and people's anxiety levels are going up and up. And they think, I'm not going to into a classroom with, you know, instead of openly saying, well, we hope they'll open, but they may not open. So this kind of idea that you is a top down diktat to a huge group of employees is really problematic, particularly, you know, where you have, you know, the as I said, it is a pandemic. It should be obvious, but it doesn't seem to be obvious. I mean, the gaps as well. So I would say, you know, the pandemic is shedding light, isn't it, on things we always knew. We always knew there was inequality, but it's shedding a light even further, bringing into sharper focus the gaps that exist in this society. So the gaps between ministers, civil service, unions, and teachers. It appears to me to be vast, and in a sense, it explains a lot in some ways. But then the gaps between, you know, really, you know, as I, you know, those children with really, as you said, who really highly depend on school, not just for quality of life, but really for survival, you know, in terms of their mental health, their interaction, you know, with other kids, and also for their parents' survival as well. They don't have the skills, you know.
No.
So the gaps are, in a sense, the gaps are widening, but they are coming into sharper focus. But this can't be addressed by suggesting that, on the other hand, that school is a panacea for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't eliminate these inequalities before the pandemic. So it's not going to eliminate them now, but what it will do is alleviate perhaps some of the impact of the pandemic. So again, that's a shift in, you know, in saying that, oh, schools, you know, is going to have this totally catastrophic effect on children and young people because they're not going every day all the time. That's different than saying some children really, really mm-hmm. need school more than others right now because they're in a pandemic. So to me, the gaps, this kind of almost like a fetishization of school, putting it up there in this pedestal, the same with the Leaving Cert, it doesn't all have to go ahead at the same time, at the same pace, if 44% of cases of COVID for the whole pandemic have been in the last 2 weeks. It just isn't why. Yeah. So there needs to be a more nuanced, respectful, engaging discussion with all of the partners in education, I would say, valuing and prioritising and starting with the most vulnerable to the closure of schooling in the pandemic. And I want school open. I want my children to go back and peace in the house and for the fridge not to be emptied every 2 hours and all the rest. But that's different to saying that, you know, the survival of a child really and their whole well-being is reliant on the inputs from the SEN, SNA teachers. It really need a more nuanced approach, I think.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, Linda. And, you know, we talked about this in the, you know, the podcast during the summer and about the idea, you know, even of, you know, when, you know, and when we do go open again, and obviously, you know, even in terms of the special needs, you know, students putting that the ideas of staggering, you know, why not, you know, stagger classes, you know, whereas of course that raises the whole issue of class sizes as well, which is another structural thing that needs to be addressed. But, you know, also we have to think that, you know, education, you're right, Linda, you know, it reflects wider societal inequalities, but we know that beyond even children with additional needs, that children in from disadvantaged backgrounds in overcrowded housing, you know, we know in terms of welfare situations that school is vital for them to, you know, for their lives to be supported, to develop further. And so along with additional needs, we need to look at the students of, you know, DESH schools, of how is that going to be progressed? And it needs to be the conversation. You're absolutely right. It needs to be genuinely focused. And of course, part of me goes to a certain extent, you know, governments haven't given an absolute crap about, you know, inequality, you know, for decades. Why suddenly it's this big concern, but well, let's take it, you know, and let's have a real conversation about how, you know, our education system can support these, but as you say, in a nuanced way. How do you think, Kira, to put the challenge straight to you, you know, if you are saying we're having special needs now, additional needs coming back, you know, that's positive to hear if it's worked out with all the partners properly. How do we then address other needs, people who need to be at school, particularly those from disadvantaged backgrounds, DESH schools? How do you think we can address that?
Well, I think the first thing we need to look at, and there's really no excuse as to why we couldn't solve this issue quite quickly, is to look at an alternative for the Leaving Cert. It doesn't make sense to me why we are holding out and so wedded to a system that does not serve anyway, and it was problematic prior to the pandemic. So I think a solution needs to be found there. to give some degree of certainty to the young people and the families who are impacted by that looming over them. We need to ask ourselves, why is it more important to send thousands of young people back into a classroom with the goal to complete an exam when we could come up with an alternative mechanism for assessing them? And there could be a degree of certainty. And if that space was created where you've suddenly shelved the demands of state exams, schools could then move to looking at how they can provide for the return to schooling in a safe and appropriate way. And I'm not just talking about a safe physical returning. I think, and I've been thinking this for a long time, that we in education are going to have to, hopefully from September perhaps onwards, at the start of the next academic year, return to schooling and education, looking at a holistic curriculum, regardless of what actually the child or the young adult is studying. I think we need to look at reintegrating people back into society and working in normal ways, and how we have conversations about working in groups and all of that. I'm really concerned about that. I mean, I know anecdotally that people are starting to talk about what it would be like, or I would be scared if, and I can't imagine sitting in Croke Park again, or what will it be like if I go to a concert again? There's massive broader societal concerns that I think education needs to, should be now accounting for and planning for, but we're not being allowed to, because we're caught up in these extra things that we just remain obsessed with, and I just don't understand it. Yeah. So I think if we could deal with the state exam issue, then schools could have a bit of space. And again, schools can't go on solo runs. We need the department to work with people on the ground to come up with solutions that, yes, can be customised at a local level, but are broadly uniform and instructive to allow schools to envisage what this will look like. And the first thing that needs to stop is the hazing of a group of professionals telling them that a place is safe to be in when we know it is not safe to be in it. That's the first. Now, they're not going to crawl down from that. And I mean, she's not going to stop saying schools are safe places to be. But so that's not going to change. So I hope that schools, I just feel that schools are just going to have to make the best of it. When they do open up, they're going to have to revert back to being a team player, wearing the green jersey, doing what they can, and just hoping to get through. But I think what we need to demand at this stage, in order to sustain, and this is what I was saying in our summer conversation back in August, if the schools are reopening, we need to talk about sustaining that reopening. And now that we're going back to reopening, or it's on the cards, how can we keep them open? And we have to look at the vaccination schedule, and we need to include those educators that work with those vulnerable groups and push them. I think they're on a level 11 as it stands. I know the Taoiseach has referenced that they might be put to level 6. That would be a huge commitment and a validation of the profession that has worked so hard to keep us going and get us to this point. And that needs to be a massive focus of the union, of all of the unions moving forward as things reopen, you know?
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right as well. You know, that's a very practical idea in terms of the vaccination. And I'll ask you before we finish, in terms of practical, because I know you've been putting around a lot of resources in terms of supporting online. So before we finish, I'll come back to you on that. What I think I want to, you know, to bring up and put to Linda, that idea you brought, when you said there, Ciara, about, you know, when we go back, when schools go back, and then when you go back in September, you know, about addressing, in a way, you know, the impact of COVID on people. But, you know, there's a broader societal impact on all of us. But we know, again, what Linda talked about is, you know, what we've highlighted here is there's a massive inequality within COVID itself. You know, we've the talk even financially of, you know, so many people are saving money, but there's a significant proportion as well who've lost jobs, who are, you know, in rent arrears, people who've lost family members. There's a huge grief, a trauma, and children in, you know, difficult situations, disadvantaged backgrounds will be traumatized, are being traumatized further. And schools will have to deal with that. Like they're the ones who deal with that. They will need support. And we need, again, to see this broader, rather than the educate, as you say, I think you're so right, rather than seeing the education thing being about how do we fulfill our state exams, how the hell do we as a society recover from this? How do we nurture, build, support our children, you know, to develop and become healthy, you know, in all well-being senses, you know, and how the schools play the role in that? What's your kind of sense of that, Linda?
Yeah, again, it's sort of hard to think that far ahead, but we should be. We should be thinking ahead in a way. I mean, you know, that we know, for instance, you know, I use that, you know, phrase, you know, where everything is exacerbated, you know, things like family violence, anxiety, you know, again, you know, there's, you know, just reading various reports, things like agoraphobia from being inside all the time. That's, you know, the fear of going out or going into groups. So absolutely, there will be a mental health fallout from this. And I suppose I think it's very important to look at the lessons from other societies. I mean, we're not the first, you know, society, I suppose, to go through something of this nature. Obviously, you can go back to TB or, you know, before that, the Spanish flu, but also look at other countries which have experienced Ebola, you know, all these other pandemics. So I think we should be preparing. I think who we define as experts is key to this. So, for instance, you know, again, if we go back, if teachers were more involved in the expert groups around COVID, maybe we wouldn't have these kinds of problems. If they were considered in the hierarchy of experts around COVID, that might be one way of dealing with it. Now, I know it's a medical emergency, so to speak. We need our vaccine people. We need our epidemiologists, our nurses, our doctors. But it's like we almost need another tier now of experts in terms of governance. And that's not to say the experts have all the answers. It's about this kind of, I suppose, pandemic planning that I'm suggesting should happen before the event rather than after the event. It's predictive social policy in a way, and it should be inbuilt into the pandemic emergency response. So perhaps one suggestion is around mental health, children and young people, that we can begin to plan around that. I think as well, we have lost an awful lot. So, for instance, something I personally miss is extended family. So as a very busy worker myself and three children, my mother is always there to step in, help with the kids, and she loves it. And that has been completely gone, that loss of, and lots of people are experiencing that. They don't have, and many don't have that. I've been very lucky, but you know, that kind of extra support, or you can call in someone to help. So it's all of those supports have been, you know, removed. And, you know, it's just there's going to have to be almost a rebuilding of society plan, isn't there, in terms of this, the socio-psychological, as well as, I'm sure it'll all be focused on the economy and getting the pubs open again. And I mean, look at what happened to us before Christmas. You'd think we would have learned. And clearly we do need to rebuild our economy. You know, we need to get people working, and there will be a massive recovery in that sense. But the economy will recover, but whether the social and the psychological recovery will happen with the same commitment, you know, I think is something exactly that, quite rightly, we should be thinking about now. And if it's not built into, I suppose, the current expertise, well, that's not really a good sign. So again, it'll fall back, as we know, in the voluntary sector, the people who are the individual teachers, the individual families. And you know, again, one would like to think if there is anything good to come of this, and at the moment it feels like there isn't, but it would be that kind of societal change. I mean, the word society has been bandied around a lot, by the way, not just in the Mother and Baby Homes report this week, this kind of abstract notion of society, but this, you saw it with schools as well, that the reason the schools were closed, because it's a societal issue. It stops the mobility in society. And this idea of schools, as I keep saying, a place apart, as being a separate zone or a sphere, you know, where children go to have all the problems of the world sorted, and that are different from the rest of the pandemic, to me, that's that's not, as you said, Ciara, earlier, it's not an inclusive way, a relational way of looking at the role and function of schools, both in our lives, our interconnections as people and communities, but also in terms of the wider, you know, social functioning of education in society. So I don't know. I'd like to see a rethink of all of these things, you know, and I think the time is now. We have so much expertise. We have so much knowledge. And, you know, we should be looking to the rebuilding of society post the pandemic. And you're right, Marie, I think mental health and the it's hard to find the words even, isn't it? Will we be traumatized? Yeah. Will we be you know, will we be, you know, afraid to go out? And some of the people who haven't been outside, you know, there's been various levels of participation in society during the pandemic. A lot of that is, again, an intersectional way of looking at it, age and you know, all that.
It's like it's a recalibration, and we're all going to go back to a new something. Nothing is the same anymore. And some people will find it easier to kick back to where they need to be, and others are going to struggle. And how are we going to assist those vulnerable groups? And I feel like it, and I'm very conscious of it. Like, say, in my space, there's been a lot of wins. And I know, Rory, you want me to talk about like remote learning and all of that and the opportunities and supports that are out there. There are, it seems crude and it seems almost inappropriate to say it, but there are a lot of wins from my area because I think it's remarkable the progress we have made. And I'm nearly reluctant to talk about it because I don't think it's appropriate even to step back and reflect yet, because we're very much in this. We're at the most serious point in this pandemic. But I would like to think that people far above my pay scale, the boffins, should be out and thinking and accounting for where we're going and where we are going to be. And we need to start projecting and long-term planning and stop this like emergency flip-flopping, trying to, who are we responding to? What lobbyist are we keeping happy this week? We need to start projecting and factoring this into long-term government planning, you know?
Yeah.
Lockdowns are an example of that, aren't they, as well? That we, you know, there hasn't been any entertaining. The idea that we can only do it the way we're doing it, so not to look to New Zealand, not to look to these countries that, you know, have, you know, it's always the reasons why we can't do this, rather than why we can, you know, or we can't adapt that. So again, there's a kind of a closure, a kind of a stagnation in terms of thinking about this, both they now govern, and the future.
They govern in news cycles, Linda, and that's why, you know, that's what's wrong. You know, we're governing to suit a model that revolves really around the Sunday paper. I mean, we're still in that cycle in Ireland, and we need to ask ourselves, why are we there? Why are we accepting that? Particularly in education, we need to expect more. We need to demand more, you know.
Yeah, and I think though as well, Ciara, on top of that, that it is a government by and governance by news cycle, but it's also a governance via conservatism. Like, there's this absolute reluctance to take big steps, to take big risks, and to challenge, I think, interests that have just dominated Irish society. Like, the decisions to you know, to open those pubs and restaurants before was just such narrow, short-term thinking that, you know, just follow the old tired, you know, model, that rather than going actually, and I think actually one of the biggest things for me has been that, you know, there's this idea, you know, Ireland has changed massively, and, you know, we are a much more progressive society, particularly in values wise, and people want an inclusive rights-based society. We're nowhere near there yet, but we are making progress. But people are also open to conversations. They want a conversation. They want to be treated by adults. And yet government still treats us like children. Departments still treat us like children.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to the structures of our political parties and the voices that dominate and the commentariat who set an agenda, and they march to the beat of that drum. And what happens then is, there, if you have somebody in politics who's particularly exciting and fresh and speaks in a plain, ordinary way, people respond to that. And that's why I think that we have certain figures who might never, for example, hold, say, a ministerial position, they'll never hold a cabinet brief, but they are particularly influential as regards people leaning towards them. It's like they look towards them for light and support, but they will never be the ones to govern as long as we like to have a couple of people who are on the outside who talk sense. But then it's like we're wedded to this system of having the same old, same old. Is it a hangover of the church? I don't know what it is. We're wedded to the system, and we want the conservative approach at all times, because it's like it's reassuring, it's all we know. There's something about the psyche of the Irish people, I think, that we just can't move from that, and we have carried on through this pandemic reflective of that.
But one would think that the idea that the reluctance to change is potentially exacerbating the pandemic problem. You know, you'd think that the penny would drop or the seed would be planted that what we actually need to change is the way we think about these issues. So the reluctance to change in a way, which you're identifying, Rory, whether it's been the Leaving Cert or whatever it is, the health system, you know, we're all blue in the, I'm blue in the face going on about everything, giving out for 30 years about so many things that we could change, you know, and change is painfully slow. But one would think that the link, the causal link between a reluctance to change, to not adopt different approaches, could actually be exacerbating people's life chances right now, their chances of catching COVID, their chances of living or dying, depending on how many ICU beds. You would think the penny would drop now and that some kind of seed, you know, would be planted that would lead to some kind of change of political culture or a change in, you know, so it's a terrible time, but it's such an interesting time as well.
Yeah,
you know?
No, and I think that there is a lot more conversations like this happening in the wider public and citizenry and people. I think even if the politicians will be slow to learn it, I think people are really going to, there's a lot more people just reflecting and thinking, and it's not being really reflected, and obviously because we are in the midst of the crisis, but I do think there will be a value reorientation and hopefully a positive one. But just to finish, maybe Kira, you could, in terms of practically outline, you know, I think it is important for people, you know, in terms of supports that are there, we are in the midst of it, we are going to be homeschooling. And, you know, in terms of third level students as well, you know, learning online for at least, you know, weeks, months maybe ahead. So, you know, I know you've been doing a lot of good work around this. So maybe you could.
Yeah, we've been trying in education circles, those of us who are active in our use of social media in order to network and support others in education, particularly at primary and second level. We've been endeavouring to support educators and parents by supplying as many free resources, tools, apps, anything we can put under the nose of people to support them during this time, because it is incredibly difficult to work through this time. Like, it's the phrase homeschooling is really grating on me, because it's not homeschooling. Homeschooling is a conscious choice that people make. This is the line I'm dishing out is emergency remote learning. At best, and what that looks like in your house will be very different to what might it might look like next door. And the keeping up with the Joneses is happening, and the mammy WhatsApp groups are flying, and there's lots of we're doing this and how much have you done and are you on Seesaw, no I'm on Class Dojo, and etc. And it's very important that parents don't persecute themselves over this, that they accept that they are trying their best to do what they can do. I think this school closure period is slightly different, because we know so much more about how children can learn in these circumstances now. Very interesting study I'd recommend that everybody has a look at is the Children's School Lives study that came out produced by researchers in UCD, supported by the NCCA. Was published just in December, and the second of two reports that they published in December revolved around analysis of children's lives during lockdown. And one of my favorite things to share with people from that study would be that your average third class pupil was capable of working anywhere between 10 to 30 minutes a day. And I think so many parents feel that they need to be trying to replicate the school day at home. It's utterly impossible to do that. Stop trying to do that. Reach in into the supports that are out there. I've decided to call your RTE school hubs and the CPB's lockdown content the infotainment that we need at this time. You're not a bad parent if you're using it. Lots of supports online. Anyone who's on social media, the hashtag on Twitter, EdShareIE, is being used to share material. Definitely have a look at that. But I would say in the first instance, whatever platform your school is operating off of, and there's what that toolbox of communication and support looks like is very different in each school. Lean into that. That might be sophisticated use of platforms such as your Seesaws of this world, or that could be something being posted to your child to complete, or it could be a very important telephone call from the teacher to anchor and support the child, depending on what's going on in their lives or what that school community has deemed to be appropriate communication. So lean into that. Try to maintain contact with the school. Try to do some work. Try to engage with your child. Try to, this time, we didn't do enough of this the last time, try to, if you can, use technology in a positive way to allow your child to socialize with other children. So if you can organize a Zoom call where it's not quite a live lesson. I saw a junior infant teacher that I know and respect greatly talk about how she had great hopes of doing a phonics lesson with a class via Zoom. And it ended up being show and tell. Show me your cat, show me your dog. But isn't that marvelous? The children, that's what they're craving at the moment. Yeah. So give them that time, give them the socializing and everything. Because as I keep saying, like, the academic loss is there, and I'm not saying that it isn't, but I am much more concerned about the relational and social loss that school closure has brought. And if parents could actually focus on that and be tuned into their child, trying to supplement meaningful conversation, if you can at all give them one-on-one time, a factor in play, conversation, connectedness, make sure you're having, you know, try to stick to the routines as best you can as regards bedtime, eating, all of that, but to just be kind to yourself. And I would say as well, second level and third level students, I would say to not be afraid to ask for help. I'm exceptionally concerned about the health and well-being of our young people at this time. Again, I just don't think it's being addressed enough. And I just want them to factor in health and well-being into their academic work, not to just have it as an other. It needs to be part and parcel of your day. And to just try and keep perspective, better days are coming and you will move beyond this, and your whole formative time will not be, and formative years will not be defined by this. And to just try to keep going, but if you're struggling, to reach out for help, you know.
No, I think there's some great advice there, Kira, and I appreciate that, and I know listeners will as well. You know, across the board, really appreciate that, and I would echo a lot of that. And in terms of, you know, my own experience and looking at it, like, I do see the kids, you know, they need the play, they need to be brought outside, they need to be, you know, as you say, the social, even the Zoom, like, we've done Zoom calls with other kids, like, you know, you do get them to set up with a friend and give them the time to do that, and not to really, you know, worry. Don't worry about the academic, as you say.
And do you know what we've identified as well? It's another thing that I've been concerned about for a long time. We overcomplicate children's lives now. Some children have a schedule that as an adult we wouldn't be able to keep up with. They're going to this class one day and this team the other day, and if maybe we need to pare back. And that's another thing. Parents need to stop putting themselves under so much pressure to be so performative in their parenting. My favorite thing about working with children is how simple and uncomplicated they are. We are the ones who complicate their lives. Pair it right back, and I guarantee you, your life will actually be easier.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Linda, do you want to add anything there, or?
Just two small things, really. I mean, you know, I think there's a balance as well between, I suppose, being realistic with the kids as well, and whatever age, obviously age in an age appropriate way. But, you know, I find it's, You know, I say to my children, you know, try and remind them that the reason they're working at home is to protect others, and that they're, you know, they're doing a good thing. And, you know, saying if not shielding them to the extent that they don't know what's going on, I'm not saying they need to know everything, but, you know, saying that so-and-so's granny up the road, you know, she has COVID, you know, and reminding them that this is something that's there and it's something we have to be aware of. I mean, I do worry about the overprotectiveness, putting my hand up, you know, when they were going to school, put on your mask, wash your hands. They come in the door, you don't say hello anymore. You say, wash your hands. You know, it's like,
quick, wash your hands, hand gel. And
you know, normally it's like, hi, how are you? How's your day? But it's like, you know, wash your bloody hands. So there's that. But then balancing it with a bit of fun. Now, the teachers won't like me for saying this, but the teenagers, you know, they put the mute on and they're laughing with their friends at the phone saying, listen what was said there. And I don't mind that at all. I think a bit of fun, a bit of awful, obviously respectful, don't get me wrong, but just being able to, because I know there's disrespectful stuff goes on.
Look, Linda, we're all big enough here to admit, I know, all three of us have been subject to WhatsApp chat in the past. We're all able for it, it's grand.
I know the student surveys, and some of it is frankly really offensive and inappropriate, but you know, just a little bit of lightness, a bit of fun with the friends, and they go on after the class and have a big laugh about what happened. And so just trying to get that balance between, they know COVID, they know what COVID is, they'll never forget it. Like, this generation will be impacted by this, there's no doubt, but at least being able to talk about that, they know what's happening, why we're at home, you know, why I'm obsessing about masks and hand washing and everything else and spraying the school bag with spray when they come in, things that were never washed in their life. So it's that, it, you know, our life is different, but I suppose being able to talk about it, I think, is really important. Mm-hmm. And the gravity of it, but also to maybe just have a bit of fun sometimes as well, difficult as it is, obviously. And you're right, not to be, the expectations have to be managed. You know, we're not going to achieve top, you know, academic outputs in the way we might perhaps be aspiring to in normal circumstances. So managing that, but I really, really, to get back to what we were talking about earlier, that has to be matched by, you know, a realistic response, and that meeting of halfway by the people who govern us, by our politicians and so forth. And just to acknowledge as well that a lot of the impact of this is falling on women. Majority of teachers are women. You know, the caring, a lot of the caring, depending on your circumstances, does fall disproportionately on women. More women have lost their jobs. I was looking at the CSO figures, just because in the States, absolutely most of the employment is in female sectors. And I do think women, you know, we need more women in politics. We need, you know, in the right kind of politics, I would say. But in general, we need more women in politics. So you know, just I suppose reminding ourselves that, you know, that we can only do what we can, women, parents, children, teachers, and, you know, that fingers crossed, you know, I do think the vaccination will be key as well, the vaccination of the grandparents. I think the teachers and the SNA should be brought up the list for vaccination, quite frankly. That would solve a lot of issues as well. So we just have to get through it, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Can I just say a little stat on that to finish up on? And this is a food for thought for everybody listening. That Children's School Lives study found that 95% of the children in the study stated that it was their mother who was primarily helping them with work. And we need to not let that happen again.
95%.
Over to you, Rory.
Well, I'm obviously in that 5%.
Oh, well, fair play to you.
Because that's the most important thing. No, I think fathers, there's a lot of fathers really need to stand up to the plate, you know, start taking it serious and playing that role. And it's you know, we still, I see it. I actually went over in the playground this morning and I counted the number of mothers and the number of fathers at 11 o'clock in the day who were over there with their kids. And it was 4 fathers and 10 mothers. And you will rarely see it any different. That was probably, I thought there was more fathers than usual over there. And that is not just because the fathers are working, and it's actually, there's still an issue of gender roles and responsibilities and that has to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But you know what? We've talked plenty, and the listeners will hopefully have really enjoyed that. You're always, I have to say, both inspiring and scintillating and thought-provoking. And also, as always, what we love on Reboot Republic, you provide lots of solutions. And I do really hope that that the educators, the Department of Education, have us signed up and listen, and the government listen, and everybody, you know, we really have these conversations because they are really needed. And I do really, really hope we have a reappraisal of our values, you know, and what education is for and what we're trying to do, because I think that is the most important thing. It is about survival. It is about supporting people and nurturing us and nurturing our children. So thank you much, Linda. Thank you very much, Linda Connolly and Ciara Riley, for joining me today in Reboot.
Thanks, Emil.
Thank you.
And as always, remind our listeners, please, we know you're listening to them. We know there's lots of you out there, and we need to keep going to keep producing these podcasts. The cost to produce, cost to host. If you can support us, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Support us for whatever you can each month. And also you get special content for patrons as well. The programs, as soon as they're produced, go out, and lots of other things. So please support us if you can. Sign up. And remember, as always, take action as well, whatever you can. If you're raised high, want to take action on these issues, contact your TD, contact your local councillor, get onto the media, highlight the issue, get onto social media, highlight the issues, and let's change society. Thank you very much.